All right, committee will come to order. First order of business, we'll take the roll.
Representatives, Chairman Ruby.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Bow. Hattlestead.
Here.
Kempnick.
Here.
Crate.
Here.
Maragos.
Here.
Mock. Monson.
Here.
Pollard.
Aye.
Scarpel.
Here.
Senators Wanzek.
Here.
Heckman.
Here.
Klein.
Here.
Lee. Mr. Chairman, you have a quorum?
All right, welcome, committee. Do we have a motion for the minutes?
I'll move.
All right, we have a motion second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. All right, the motion carries. We'll start right away with the presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name for the record is Gordy Smith with the State Auditor's Office. I'm the Performance Audit Manager, and we'll be going over this, the performance audit we did recently of the system office. If you would, please turn to page 1. This chapter 1 is some information here. The objective to our audit that we came up with is the university system adequately staffed to perform its functions. And one of the things we found as we got into this report is how difficult that is to determine when you start comparing to other state systems. We do not feel that just a simple comparison of the overall staffing levels to other states is by itself a reliable way to determine if a system office is adequately staffed, because of the differences in responsibilities of each of the university system offices in different states, the number of institutions, the number of students, and the differences in the amount of centralization. Considering that and looking at certain areas within the system office, we feel the staffing is low. However, we also feel, as I'll get into later, that if staffing at the campus level were to be considered in the comparison, because it's not centralized, even the areas that appeared low would then be comparable to other states. The third bullet down is something I'll discuss at length a little later. We identified no plan for the system office that documents the functions of the office, what the office is attempting to accomplish, or any performance measures which could be used in determining if the office functions in an efficient and effective manner. And as I'll mention later, the office is not mentioned at all in the university system strategic plan that the board put together. I'd like to go over on page 2. We'll talk about the staffing level. The staffing level that we came up with at the university system office is 113.5. Now, that might seem high from what you've heard. The first thing I'd point out is that 30.5 of those work directly within the system office. 83 of those work for what is referred to as SITS, the acronym, System Information Technology Services. It's basically the consolidation of IT services within higher education. The unusual thing there is that the funding for those
We have a question. Representative Scarpel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gordy, how does that work? Because if they're actually system employees, how are they not reflected in the system office?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scarpel, in this way, and it is unusual, the FTE is reflected both at UND and NDSU, where the Joint Information Technology Services has been operating prior to prior to this. There was the HECN network, and historically a long time ago, the funding related to those positions was included in NDSU and UND's budget, much like the positions are now. However, the actual funding to pay for those is located within the university system office, and the CIO, who at this point in time is a contracted employee, these positions at the SITS, those 83 positions do report to him, and he's included within our count of working for the university system office.
Continue.
So does the system office contract for these FTEs with the money that's in their budget? Because if the FTEs are actually FTEs of the institutions, how can their salary originate somewhere else?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I can answer that. I can tell you this, the SITS employees are not contracted employees. They are employees of the university system including up until this biennium, those positions, actual positions, are located within the universities of NDSU and UND, the majority of them at NDSU. But that funding is actually even a separate line item within the university system office budget, the SITS.
Representative Kempany.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Gordy, who does the CIO answer to then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kempany, the CIO would answer to the Chancellor.
Okay, the Chancellor contracts then the CIO?
Mr. Chairman, I think originally that position, as it was contracted, was to be temporary in nature, and I think that I believe the system office has tried to hire a CIO for that position and hasn't been successful. So the person right now is a contracted employee. I go on here. One thing that I guess I want to make sure that we, you know, that you're aware of when we discuss these, when we discuss positions here for a university system, a position doesn't equal an FTE like it would in state government. The FTE that's reported by the university system is only those positions paid for by, for the university system office, in that case, is general funds. So the people who are paid with general funds upstairs in the university system office would be what that FTE number is stated at. But anybody else who's paid could be with federal funds because they administer our grants. It could be with the assessed funds that we'll talk about where the Chancellor's office has assessed those others. But the numbers we come up with is 30.5, which is why that wouldn't jive with numbers that are reported either to the legislators or in the media. That's the reason for the difference.
Representative Munson.
Mr. Chairman, so Gordy, do they appear anywhere, or is it just that because of your audit you stumbled upon these 30-some people?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that if somebody was doing a head count, if you wanted to describe it as that those are people that are working within the office upstairs. But if you went by an FTE count within the university system office, only general funded positions are the ones counted. And that's important when someone's discussing FTE, whether it be FTE within the university system itself or the system office. But that's the way it's set up. Nowhere else in state government, I mean, if the auditor's office reported its FTE, it would be the ones that work for us that are funded by local political sub dollars, those that work for the federal government, and all those general funded ones. But it's just an important distinction that I want to make sure the committee members are aware of.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Gordy, they must show up on payroll through the state payroll system and get health insurance and all that.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Munson, they do show up. Obviously, they get paid, they get accrued leave, they health insurance like everybody else, but in the actual amount, FTE that's reported, it's only the generally funded position.
Representative Scarpa.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gordy, does the same thing apply at the institutions? Do the FTEs reflected at the institutions, are they only paid for with general funds and other?
I would say with appropriated dollars, because general fund is in with the tuition dollars and those aren't separated. But yes, if someone said how many FTE are there in the university system, the number of employees would be significantly higher. The number you would be provided would only be those funded by appropriated dollars.
So there are employees in each of the institutions that are funded by other funds other than appropriated funds as well. So this practice is not unique to the system office, but it's unique to the university systems as a whole, including the institutions.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scarpa, that's correct.
Representative Maragos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just so since I don't sit on appropriations, you say that there's 30.5 that are directly within the system office, and then there's 83 in the SITS section. So does that mean there's seven positions in the system office that are not paid with appropriated funds?
Mr. Chairman, it said, I guess, I'm sorry, I'm down a couple paragraphs. Starting the system office had a legislatively approved amount of 23.3 for the current position, for the current biennium. So the difference between those two, the 30.5 and the 23.3, would be employees that are not paid with general funds.
Okay, so it would be by seven.
Be seven of them, right.
Well, and Gordy, on your Appendix B, way towards the back, B1, of the 30.5, it shows the chancellor as one of those.
Mr. Chairman, that's right.
Representative Maragos.
Looking at table B1, Gordy, you did not break out the five that are not, or the 7.2 mm-hmm. that are not. Was that done for a reason?
I would imagine we could if we were asked. There was no reason that we thought to break them out. As I continue here, then down, I'm still on page two. As we looked at the staffing levels, during our audit field work, you know, our audit is recording, you know, when we're talking about position levels as of June 30th of 2012. But since that time, during our field work, we identified a significant amount of turnover within the office after that June 30th, 2012. Some positions have yet to be filled. We identified some new positions that were created. We also, this would be where I guess we're introducing that the campuses are being assessed for the cost of certain positions. And then I'll get into those. I guess I would go over to page three to start the first area where we're looking at a discussion of findings. When we compared to other institutions, we grabbed eight other states, and there was a total of nine university systems there because Minnesota has one for the University of Minnesota by itself, and then the rest of the colleges and universities are a second one. The first area that we looked at would be internal audit. In nine of these systems, seven of them had internal audit functions that were staffed either equivalent to what the system was or more. Six appeared to have a higher staffing level. Those range from 1 to 17.5 positions. One area we thought maybe that would give us at least a little bit of a guideline is we used student headcount of each of the systems. So there in the second paragraph, the first one under internal audit, we discussed what some of those ratios were. The South Dakota system had 36,000 student headcount to one internal auditor, etc. North Dakota has, our system office had one position as of June 30th of 2012. However, since then an additional position was approved by the board in July of 2012, however, it's still not filled yet as of the end of January of 2013. However, we also noted that there are three internal auditors, two at UND and one at NDSU. So when we said if those were centralized, there'd be a total of five internal auditors, and when you factor in a student headcount of 49,000, we'd have a little less than 10,000 to 1 ratio, which to us is more than well within what these other states identified. So we have identified before these three internal audit positions, and we've included recommendations that they should report to the internal audit position that currently exists at the university system office, Instead, these three positions report to their respective presidents. Now, our concern with that would be, from an independence standpoint, that you're working, in effect, for somebody who you could be auditing and presenting the results. And I guess the, without belaboring it, the perfect example would be if their Dickinson State had had an internal auditor reporting to the prior president, and they wanted to do an audit on some of the things that were found there, I'm saying the odds are that president could probably kill that, or else the auditor would lose his lose his job. But this isn't just our feelings. In the Institute of Internal Auditors, that's the national organization that sets standards for internal auditors, they too would regard those three internal auditors at the two university systems as not being independent. And the result of that is we certainly can't rely on any of their work, and neither should the internal auditor at the university system office, because of the independence problem.
Gordy, we have a question. Representative Scarpa.
Thank you. Gordy, you say in your narrative here, you say the three campus internal auditors were to report to the system office. If the three campus internal auditors, are you suggesting they can remain employees of that institution but have to report to the system office? Is that a workable relationship in your mind?
Mr. Chairman, that would be a workable relationship as long as the internal audit director that's at the university system office holds the power to hire, fire, evaluate the work of, help set the audit schedule of, review the report drafts that the person generates, those kind of things. Yes, there's certainly more than enough work, I'm sure, at those two big universities for three internal auditors to keep themselves more than busy. So we would not, we're not suggesting those should relocate to Bismarck or something like that.
Continue.
Well, I'm questioning the logic of them being employees of that president of that institution as opposed to being employees of the system office, is my point. I mean, does that seem to be logical to you?
Mr. Chairman, ideally, from my perspective, yeah, if I could, I would have them funded and have them be employees of the university system itself. That's what I think is the ideal. I don't believe that we would suggest that, again, that they have to relocate or anything. We're just saying that everything that person depends on for their job should be at the university system office, their supervisor in that case.
Representative Maribos.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Gordy, if they're within the system office, they're still under the auspices of the State Board of Higher Education, who determined ultimately that's where they were going to be placed. What's the distinction?
from our perspective, yes, the internal audit manager that works for the system office now reports to the board audit committee, the subcommittee. And that is what is recommended by Institute of Internal Auditors, is that you report to an independent audit committee, so you wouldn't have, I mean, administratively, you know, who would sign things would obviously be the chancellor, that would be an administrative reporting, but hiring and firing and that kind of thing would come from this independent audit committee. That's the arrangement that's set up to capitalize on the independence.
Continue.
Is that a euphemistic term, independent audit committee?
Well, I guess to me, I guess as independent as it's going to be if it's from the audit, if you wanted, I mean, ideally, you know, I think there is certainly a good amount of work and certainly a justification to have internal auditors within the university system itself. However, I think that is compromised severely if those auditors are reporting to their prospective presidents. If they're reporting to an audit committee, then at least the board, who's charged with the governance of the institutions of the system, then they're the ones that are going to be making, you know, decisions as to what is or isn't released as a result of that. Now, they're probably not They're certainly not as independent as the state auditor's office, but those board members would be as independent as they could probably get within the university system.
Representative Scarborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gordy, I'm assuming you didn't look back at the history to see who made the decision at these institutions to hire that internal auditor. You wouldn't have an opinion about whether they were hired at the request of the board or at the request of the president.
Mr. Chairman, I would not know that.
All right, thank you.
Representative Scarborough. The next area we looked at was legal counsel. In all of the 9 systems that we looked at had legal counsel. 7 of those had a higher staffing level, and they went from 1 to 37. Our system office has 2 legal counsel. The majority of the time, 65% of these 2 staff time is spent working with the 9 smaller institutions. Again, we tried to identify some sort of a ratio with student headcount. So currently, if you looked at those 2, we have 2 for the 49,000 headcount students. However, at NDSU and UND, we identified 5 legal counsel positions that were attorneys, 2 legal assistant positions. So what we're saying, and if those are taken into account in figuring your ratio, you'd have 9 for the 49,000 headcount, and your ratio would be about 5,400 to 1, which is well within the ranges we found. So once again, if those are considered part of it, now we're not, you know, I'm not saying, again, this is different than the internal auditors. I'm not saying that those 7 positions then need to report to the to a board audit committee or to some other subcommittee. We're just saying that they should be taken into account when you're figuring if they're adequately staffed. And it's a determination of the board, the legislature, if any of those would be changed from reporting to within the 2 university system, 2 universities they currently do, to whether then they would be reporting in the same way that the 2 positions we have upstairs are. We're just saying if you take those in, then it appears to us that they're adequately staffed in the legal area. My recommendation over on page 5, 1-1, we recommend the university system take appropriate action to obtain the necessary resources to adequately perform function and duties. This should include determining whether campus resources can be used in centralizing certain function and providing support for personnel costs. The university system's response is we agree. The Board of Higher Education and the university system office have identified the need to this. They've identified several positions that need to be added, and they're exploring the option of obtaining necessary resources from the campuses to ensure we carry out our responsibilities. The next area there is establishing a monitoring function.
Gordy, before you go on, I mean, that last comment there kind of is contradictory of on page 1 where, of course, we don't have numbers on the sentences, but in the third of the last paragraph there, it says, however, resources within the entire university system may be available to adequately staff the system office, and we did not identify any amount of staffing needed due to the factors listed above. So is there adequate dollars within the system, or do they need to ask the legislature for more?
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent question. From our perspective, we don't think that enough time has been spent determining if there are adequate resources within the university system itself. I think that determination needs to be made by the board and by the legislature, because I don't think just comparing us, so we have two legal counsel and some other system that's really centralized, so all the legal counsel for all the institutions are in one place. If they have 10, I don't think we're understaffed by 8. I think there's a possibility here that there has to be some more in-depth analysis gathered to determine whether exactly what you say, whether they can find those resources from the additional 7 legal people that are at the campuses, or if there's a need for more to take care of the, well, 65% of the 2 in Bismarck are spent, of their time is spent working with the 9 smaller campuses. So, I mean, that says something.
Okay, Representative Scarborough.
All right, thank you. And Gordy, it seems to me we're kind of caught in the circle here, because what you're suggesting is that analysis needs to be done to determine whether or not a reorganization should take place, and I'm wondering who's supposed to do that analysis? Because if the institutions are looking unfavorably on a reconfiguration of people, what motivation would they have to do it? And if the system office is understaffed and don't have the personnel to do the proper analysis, how's it supposed to happen?
Mr. Chairman, again, Representative Scarpo, that's a good question. I guess from our standpoint, obviously the policymakers are, it's the legislature. But I think that the university system office, there's been a significant amount of reorganization within that office that has already taken place. And I think that it really does fall to them if they're going to generate the argument or generate the stance that additional staff is needed, then I think they have to, they would be the one charged with supporting that stance. And if I don't think that, well, from what we were shown, there, I do not believe that there's enough been done for them to justify to say, we're going to need X amount more attorneys than the ones that, the two here and the seven that are out with the two biggest campuses. We didn't look at, again, you know, how much time the seven at the individual campuses, we didn't look at where do they spend all their time. But if you think that the two attorneys here spend 65% of their time with those nine universities, to me, I would wonder, why isn't it 100%? You know, or some higher percent if that's your focus. There are some cases where the university system office, let's say the general counsel, they may be doing work that would apply to the system as a whole. If maybe UND or NDSU's attorneys couldn't agree on how to interpret something and they wanted additional perspective, I'm sure they would ask the system office general counsel. So there may be some of that person's time. Otherwise, the people within the office now spend two-thirds of their time on the nine campuses. So I don't know what additional need where they would spend their time without some additional analysis of what they feel they're missing now.
Let's continue.
My question, though, Gordy, is, you know, this analysis needs to take place, and if it's perceived that there is a need for a shifting of personnel from the campuses to the system office, that's the conclusion. When does your audit envision that taking place? Because under current law, the system and the board cannot take money appropriated to an institution. They could take the FTEs, but they can't take the money. An FTE without money is a rather useless entity. So are you suggesting that this analysis take place over the next 2 years so that it can bring forward a proposal that would recommend proper staffing levels at the system office?
Mr. Chairman, certainly I think that's one option, that it would be done over then. But I would also bring up that currently the practice within the office is I can think of five positions that they've assessed back to campuses that, you know, for positions within the system office. And so I don't know if that's an option, you know, that they would raise the money that way. I don't know if the board would consider somehow realigning resources and they hire a firm to take a look at those kind of things. But certainly by next session, you know what I mean? I certainly would think that there would be a definitive answer to that question and reasonable support to justify whether increasing the office staff or not.
Continue.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Smith, you know, obviously that's still pending, but the House passed a bill, said they can't assess the campuses. If that bill passes, that option's off the table.
Mr. Chairman, that would be true.
Representative Kempnick, did you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's more of a statement, but it looks like we got three systems within the higher education, because they're, you know, and that's where, you know, to follow this, and that's kind of dovetailing off of Representative Scarpo's, that, you know, to get this together, because you basically got basically three systems that are running concurrent with each other, and, you know, we got the nine universities, obviously, and I'm sure that's what the internal audit for the one, you know, like for the system office, that you'd call a system office, and then you got the other two systems that are operating pretty much independent of the system. And I think that's probably part of the catch on this whole conversation we're having here, is we got three systems going, but that's just my opinion.
All right, we'll move on.
Mr. Chairman, on page 5, establishing a monitoring function, the first paragraph we cite what has really kind of become one of the standards for, in looking at internal control. It was back in like 1985, this organization got together and defined what internal controls would be. And one of the main processes is the need to be, as it says there in the middle of the first paragraph, the need to be monitored. We identify the lack of monitoring of the system office operations itself, as well as a system-wide of the campus's monitoring. We identified a number of non-compliance issues that the system office itself has with Board of Higher Ed policies. For example, we cite there in the second paragraph in that area, board policy requires written contracts to exist for payments for services, and legal counsel is to review every contract. We found three contracts that either didn't have any written contract to support the payments, or the contract itself doesn't appear to be reviewed by legal counsel because it's missing standard things that the Attorney General recommends be in every contract that the state enters into. So that's an area there, just the lack of monitoring within the university system office itself. We also identify the lack of adequate review of laws, policies, and procedures. We noted a number of them were either outdated or don't reflect current practices. Over on top of page 6, we also say there's a lack of a system-wide monitoring. No monitoring or very limited monitoring takes place on a system-wide basis, monitoring the institution's compliance with Board of Higher Ed policies and the procedures that exist. A sound system of internal control requires that you would have a monitoring aspect, and therefore in recommendation 1-2 there, we recommend the system office establish a system-wide monitoring function for the university system. At a minimum, it is sure to ensure the system office itself, as well as the institutions, are in compliance, state, federal, and university system requirements, and review the operations of the system office and institution to identify significant risks, an area where improvements in efficiency and effectiveness are needed. The university system office agrees, and in November of 2012, a chief compliance officer was hired to implement and administer compliance program for the university system. They plan for ongoing monitoring to ensure compliance and identify risk areas. They state additional FTEs will be necessary to fully implement the program. At the bottom of page 6.
Excuse me, Representative Starple.
Thank you. Remind us, Gordy, what the time frame was for this audit.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the time frame for this audit was fiscal year 11, fiscal year 12, and then the first 3 months through September of 2012. And we conducted the work, obviously, from October, November, through, I'd say, the first week of February.
First 3 months of 2013.
Fiscal
year 2013.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
At the bottom of page 6, we discuss an area ensuring a unified system of higher ed exists. As we note, in 2001, there was a section codified into North Dakota Century Code that states the institutions of higher ed under the control of the state board are a unified system. In previous performance audits we've conducted, we identify concerns related to the university system not being unified. While steps have been taken by the system office to make certain areas more unified, such as a transfer of credits between institutions, there are a number of other areas where a unified system simply does not exist. Certain functions could be centralized, which would lead to more streamlined processes, and probably a shift of resources from a campus-specific function to a university system function. Some of the areas we've established before where there was a lack of a unified system was capital projects as well as student fees. In this one, we note that there, each institution has their own financial aid manual. No system-wide manual exists. Each entity also prepares their own financial statements, and the system office tries to put those all together. And historically, they've been unable to prepare financial statements in accordance with the GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles, without a substantial number of audit adjustments required by our office.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Maragos.
Gordy, that's quite a statement. So I'm assuming that you have brought that issue to us in previous audits. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Because I've been on a legislative audit and fiscal review every interim, and for some reason I don't have any recollection of that. So who do you ascribe responsibility for the unification of the system? Who has ultimate responsibility in that?
Mr. Chairman, the Board of Higher Education, I would say. If the law's been passed, to say you're going to be a unified system, you should be a unified system. That's what the policymakers decide.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Continue.
Well, judging by the separation between the legislature and the state board, is that a doable thing? Do we have any control in that area?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm of the belief, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I'm of the belief that the legislature is a policy-making branch of government. They are the ones that decide what appropriations get distributed where, and whatever their decision is one that has to be followed. I don't know any other way that it's going to work.
One more question.
Continue.
If I understand you correctly, what you're saying then is the state board really is not responding appropriately to the policies established by the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maragos, I think it's a big job for the board, but frankly, the system, the way it's set up, and by that I mean, I'll give you an example here. I think there's 50 areas that we could point out where the board has basically said each institution can pass their own policy for how to handle something. And without there being an overarching one that sets up what are the limits. Not every university is the same. You can't compare the medical school with Wahpeton or something like that. But there's got to be some overarching guidance there. And because of that's the way it's been for a long time, there's going to be growing pains getting it to where it really is a unified system. In the middle of the page 7 there, there was a risk assessment that the university system had in 2011, and a couple parts of that we found interesting. The first bullet there on page 7, the report states, quote, the system does not consistently operate as a unified system of higher ed, with the primary focus on what is in the best interest of the student and the state as opposed to the institution. The second bullet says that there are risks that, quote, appears to be significant opportunities to improve effectiveness and efficiency as a system by focusing on consistency of approach and collaboration for both academic and administrative functions. So, it isn't just us, as I had said. Certainly in our audit on capital projects, we identified in the report that in that area they weren't operating as a unified system. We did the same within the fees audit, but this is from an outside vendor that they had that took a look at this. The final thing, I guess, that we relied on here, we interviewed senior staff upstairs at the university system office. Three of those staff, as well as the current chancellor, told us that they don't have a unified system. We interviewed the board members in August and September. Three of those members told us that they don't believe that we have a unified system. And so What we're basically saying in 1-3 there, we recommend the university system office take appropriate action to identify there is a unified system of higher education. If that is unattainable, appropriate action should be taken to remove the unified system language and laws and make appropriate changes to the higher education organization structure and operations. In other words, I mean, either you're continually moving towards being a unified system or you're not, and then you shouldn't be having a law that says you are.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kempinick.
Mr. Chairman, and Gordy, so we should, if they don't want to become a unified system, then we should probably have a study in where we turn them into private institutions and the state get out of the business of higher education. Because that's, you know, that's been a problem, a theme here for the last few years. It isn't just today. And it is disconcerting about that. And truthfully, I think that's what some of them would like to be, is run a, be a private institution and not answer to anybody. And I think it really is kind of the thread that we're hearing here is really disconcerting to me anyways.
Mr. Chairman, I guess Representative Kemp, yeah, we're not saying privatize all of these guys, but we're basically saying this once again. The legislature is a policy-making branch of government, and if the legislators direct that a system, a unified system, is to exist, then to me, 12 years after they've done that, we ought to be farther down the trail towards a unified system. And I think certainly the current board, the current chancellor, would like to move in that direction. Now, whether they're successful or not, again, it you know, it depends on what they do in the future. It depends on how each of the institutions react. It depends on how the legislature themselves react to what their constituents say, etc.
Senator Heckman.
Mr. Chairman and Gordy, on that management's response in there, it says the State Board of Higher Education has directed the University System Office to ensure that unified system. To me, it's the board's job to ensure that. With the system office and with the chancellor, it seems to me that in here, the way it's stated is that the board has taken themselves out of the picture here. I guess I'm not sure of that comment there.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, again, it's hard for me to speak for the board, but I think here the university system office is probably viewed by the board, since the board is a part-time entity, as someone who's going to react to that directive. They oversee that, and they expect then the university system office to take whatever actions necessary to try to bring things into a unified system.
Representative Scarpa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gordy, on the bottom of page 7, that third bullet, you didn't mention it. In the very last sentence in that third bullet, it's intriguing to me, and I'm wondering if in your analysis of that risk assessment, there was more said than just that with regard to the utilization of PeopleSoft, because the inconsistency of institutions in their seemed ability to utilize uniform accounting codes has also been always been bothersome to me. Was there more to that risk analysis or risk assessment with regard to the utilization of PeopleSoft? Because I admit I haven't read the thing.
Mr. Chairman, my staff tells me that within that report there is some drill down to the individual institution levels, but that there wasn't, you know, it's not an expansive part of that report from what we have here. I would say that, you know, we'll show later, there's a recommendation we have as far as making sure information is accurate that comes out of the institutions, and we have one example where it doesn't, but some of that might be a result of how people are using PeopleSoft, the different systems, or how what parameters they're using when they draw their information from it.
Alan, would you get me a copy of that risk assessment, please?
Representative Maragos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gordy. You know, I'm looking back on page 6 and the Century Code section 15.1001.2. The institutions of higher education under the control of the State Board of Higher Education are a unified system of higher education. Was there a definition of a unified system in code? Who gets to establish what a unified system? That could mean many different things to many different people. How could you possibly interpret that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maragos, I don't believe that they define that in there. I would tell you from the auditor's office perspective, the first thing I think on that list in order to determine that would be that board members and senior staff would assert that they've got a unified system, which is not happening now. That would be number one. Number two, I would think that there would be a limited number of instances, very limited number of instances where the, you know, all the institutions are going their own way, like a, you know, the financial aid manuals or something. I don't know if we ever get to somewhere, you know, where every person can say they're a unified system. I really can't say that. But I think the place to start is if they even consider themselves one.
Continue.
If I make it. Well, you know, it's an interesting statement about the institutions kind of going their own way. You and I know that they come down here and present their budgets and get their marching orders, and I haven't seen a lot except for a couple of, you know, we all know the different little blurbs that have appeared on the screen. So I kind of am not so sure I would concur that the institutions really go their own way. That seems like a rather broad swipe of the brush, and I just wanted to comment on that.
Senator Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two comments. One is, I think it's really important, whether we like it or not, there is a constitutional independent authority that the Board of Higher Education has since the 30s, and we can't ignore that. We may wish that they were like the Human Services Department or the Department of Transportation. We shoot the money out there, they do what we say. It isn't like that. And so whether we like it or not, we have to remember that, and we have to work within the parameters of what the Constitution permits us to do and permits them to do. The other thing is, all of the universities are in the business of educating students, and I think they do a pretty darn good job of that. And if the board is not, through its office and on its own terms, broadly directing a move towards a unified system, I think the universities are more than busy with the resources they have available, trying to make sure that education of those students is not interrupted. I've had a couple of people just this last week or so talk about this being a fight among presidents again. I absolutely resist that suggestion, because I am not, at least personally, I am not seeing and hearing that at all. And I obviously live in the Fargo area where NDSU is, and I'm very familiar with a whole lot of friends in Grand Forks, and that's my alma mater. I just don't believe that they are, that we have two fine presidents there and two universities doing a great job. And I think we have to get past the idea that there's some kind of food fight among the universities and colleges themselves. But if these very capable presidents and the people who are in place in all of those 11 institutions don't have a sense of direction that is provided for them by the board through the university system office, what are they supposed to do? I mean, I think, again, as Senator Heckman has mentioned as well, there's some fault, and I'm not trying to blame anybody, but I think the responsibility for the direction does in a large part lie with the board, because they are supposed to be the leaders in helping to develop through the university system office this unified plan. So I think we got to be careful we're not targeting the wrong, we're not shooting at the wrong folks here.
Continue.
Mr. Chairman, on the bottom of page 8, we have a section entitled Improving Plans for the University System. We identified a lack of a documented plan establishing the functions, duties, and expectations of the system office. State Board of Higher Education policy requires each institution to adopt a strategic plan and implement a planning process that involves the faculty, staff, and institution constituents. That same policy requires these institutional strategic plans to be to define institutional priorities to carry out the institution's missions, but also that they be aligned with the university system's strategic plan and the board policy. However, no such requirement exists, and no plan exists to our knowledge, for the system office itself. The university system's strategic plan includes no reference to the system office. We identified no plan for the system office to document specific requirements or what the system office was attempting to accomplish in a given time period. Now, determining whether the office is performing well or meeting expectations is certainly hindered by the lack of an established benchmark or measurement. It also hinders reaching a conclusion as to the appropriate amount of resources needed for the system office itself. When this committee asked us to do this audit, one of the things that they asked us to look at was to review the effectiveness of the office to provide support to campuses and address and resolve university system issues. It's unclear what functions and support were actually provided by the system office, as this has yet to be formally documented. As a result, accountability for the system office is lacking, as no expectations are established and documented. Based on discussion with system office representatives, even the area of support of the campuses is done on a case-by-case basis is affected by whether the system office had the resources or expertise to provide that support. We have some more things at the bottom of the page, a couple bullets of where there may be a potential disconnect because what the public or the legislature or other stakeholders are expecting and what actually happens, there's no way of knowing whether those expectations are aligned or should be changed. We did survey certain, I'll move on to page 10 now.
Mr. Chairman, before we move on. So, you know, the statements you made up on top of 9, and basically that's probably part of the reason why there's really not a, what you'd call a unified system. Because it looks to me, and that's the thread too, is a communication aspect of what's going on here, that or the lack of it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kempenick, I guess I admit to being pretty surprised again 12 years afterwards, and obviously the university system has put an enormous amount of time in moving towards that goal, doing, you know, making decisions and those kind of things, but there's literally nothing that we saw that would establish what the system office's job is, what their expectation, how they're supposed to function, what all they're supposed to do. There, you know, whereas there is for each individual university, and there is a board plan that umbrellas over all the university's plans, but there is nothing that we were able to find for the board office. And to me, I think that's problematic because it's hard to tell, you know, do you even know where you're going? Are you planning down the line so that what you're doing specifically aligns with what the board is directing to be done in its overarching plan?
Well, that's what I'm getting, the feeling of a cog within a cog, and you got the board that's got some cogs, but they don't reach out far enough. You got the system office that doesn't have any cogs on it, and then you got these institutions running around and nothing's catching. I mean, that's exactly how it looks to me, is that, you know, and that's what, you know, and yeah, I can see why there's probably some dysfunction in what's going on in this, because if you aren't connected to it, it's hard to, you know, and you can't do it on a case by case. Any gear that isn't catching all the gears isn't going to work. It just jumps once in a while. So okay.
Over on page 10 on that bullet, we did conduct a survey of various campus representatives to obtain information related to the system office. We asked them, one of the things, to prioritize what they believe are the roles of the chancellor in the system office. We had 79 respondents who replied to that question. 21 indicated it should be to advocate on behalf of the institutions to the board and the legislature. But there were 20, which would be this, you know, right behind it, who say the number one priority is to carry out a vision capitalizing on the collective assets and capabilities of the individual institution to meet state needs. So, I mean, those are so I guess, diverse, and then there's, those were the leading two responses. Our recommendation here is that the university system office develop a plan to establish expectations and use the plan to guide resource allocations. The response from the university system office is they agree, and they review and consolidate their strategic plan into one document and more clearly identify the resources required for it. I'd like to go over to page 12 in chapter 2. We looked at some functions within...
One moment, Gordy.
I'm sorry.
Charlie.
Just a quick comment since we're moving on to the next chapter. When we hear Representative Kempinick's metaphor about the gears and the outside of the wheel that's turning of the universities, that's the one that's working. The universities, the various institutions in the university that are educating students are continuing to educate students. So that part of that wheel is moving. And they're doing that whether or not anything catches in the middle or not. And I think connecting it back together again can work. But it's not, I think we've got to make sure we're not beating up on the university because they've got the traction. They're providing the education. But we've got to figure out how we can enable the board and the systems office to get caught up in that, because otherwise they're non-essential.
Well, that's the whole concept there is because the everybody's getting hit on the ground, you know, something up here is really great. You know, you got some type of power to turn it on.
All right, yeah. We'll move on.
On page 12, chapter 2, the first area is discussing an early retirement agreement. On October 8th of 2012, the Chancellor signed an early retirement agreement with the former System Office General Counsel. The agreement identified the employee's retirement date as November 5th of 2012. We identified the total cost of this early agreement to be approximately $145,000, which does not include the required payout to the individual for their earned annual and 10% of their sick leave while employed. A couple of the bullets there that we'll discuss what's in there. The first one is the university system office is going to pay this employee's health insurance through June 30th of 2017. Our estimate is that's $38,000, but that's assuming there is no increase in the health insurance premiums from now till then. The second bullet was there is agreement included provisions to grant annual and sick leave through June 30th of 13, even though the individual was no longer an employee as of November 5th of 2012. The third bullet discusses that approximately $90,000 of the monies assessed from the nine campuses in the SITS office that was assessed to them from the legal positions were used to pay the early retirement installments as well as a payment for sick and annual leave earned. We looked at the Board of Higher Education policies. If the former general counsel was to be terminated without cause, board policy required a 12-month notice to be provided. We identified that in another case, the system office did provide a 12-month notice of termination to the Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs. The employee retained their title and was assigned to Bismarck State College to work on special projects. The salary for the employee remained the same. The policy I referred to as far as requiring 12 months has now been changed to 6 months. One other aspect that was included in that agreement is the last paragraph. Over $10,000 of employer contributions to the employee's TIA CREF retirement account were to be made. That is specifically against a board policy, which, as we quote there, shall not include employer contributions. Thus, this aspect was in non-compliance with the board policy. Our recommendation over on page 13 is that they comply with the board policy and ensure early retirement agreements only include payments authorized by the policy. The university system's response is they agree and they will ensure early retirement agreements comply with the policy.
What do they do with the past ones? Are those just grandfathered in?
Mr. Chairman, I would expect that's exactly what would happen, is that I don't know where their cutoff would be if you have to work here 3 years and then you would be eligible for needing six months as far as without cause termination, or if it would be longer than that.
55 months of health insurance. That seems excessive.
Mr. Chairman, I guess from our perspective, it's awfully unusual, well, any early retirement agreement for the rest of state government is a little unusual, and so even seeing these and using the assessment from the 9 campuses to pay for that when they're assessed for legal services for the period they were assessed, I'll get into that a little later.
Yeah, we have about 3 questions coming.
Okay.
Representative Maragos? Representative Munson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gordy, on the bottom of page 12, that last sentence has me kind of curious. It continues on 13. It appears the employer contribution provision was not properly identified in the drafting and reviewing of the agreement. So the State Board of Higher Ed passed no motion to waive the requirement. How did that? Was that an attempt to hide it, or?
That's awfully difficult for us.
I know it
would be us for us to decide, but I would say that, you know, the agreement obviously was negotiated between the former general counsel, so a lawyer there, and a lawyer that at the time worked for the Attorney General's office. And somehow in between there, they missed that particular aspect of the agreement as far as what the board policy was.
Senator Heckman.
Mr. Chairman and Gordy, addressing this whole statement here on page 12, does the chancellor then have a blank check to do this, or is the final approval lie with the board on this issue that was before us here?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Heckman, when we looked at this, you know, because it's part of negotiations, that those first 2 bullets, at least, that those kind of things, we could find nothing that prohibited them. So I would say that, yes, the chancellor has the ultimate authority in what they want to do as far as that agreement, but obviously I would assume that the chancellor would then seek some sort of approval from the board, or at least visit with the board on that.
Continue.
And you didn't find any of that? You didn't find board approval, or?
We did not find any board approval of the specific agreement, no.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Representative Scarpo.
Did you look?
I'm told, Mr. Chairman, that the policy by the Board of Higher Ed gave the chancellor the authority to sign and then negotiate the early retirement agreement. So by extension, if that's a policy, the board's aware they granted that authority. Over on page 13, as we had talked about assessing campuses for system office positions, there's a series of bullets, and I hope this will provide some background because it can get confusing. But a special fund called the Internal Audit Campus Share was established for the initial assessment of campuses in fiscal year 2012 to pay the costs of the Director of Internal Audit and Risk Assessment position. Prior to this fund, the position was paid with general funds. In July of 2012, the new chancellor sent a memo to board members related to the fiscal 13 system office annual budget. The memo identified a proposed board motion to authorize the addition of a senior level internal auditor and a senior level compliance officer position to be funded with additional campus assessment. This would increase the number of positions paid using campus assessment monies to 3. At its July 12th state board meeting, the board office approved a motion to add those 2 positions to the system office and fund the costs with campus assessments. The minutes of the meeting state that the chancellor, quote, supports the assessment of costs for audit staff to campuses and asks that the assessments be extended to include additional legal staff. We identified no state board motion approving campuses be assessed for those 2 additional legal staff. In the following month, August of 2012, a memo from the chancellor to the chancellor's cabinet, a schedule was included for the assessment of those the early, I mean, the additional internal audit position and the new compliance position that had been approved by the board. The memo also stated that starting October 1, 9 campuses and sits would be assessed for the cost of legal services. The memo stated for the two legal services within the system office, the cost of services would be paid by the system office 30%, which is general fund sits, and the nine smaller campuses would pay 65% of it. Campuses submitted their payment for their assessments in August through October. All monies received for these five positions are quoted using the same fund. We identified that as of the end of January 13, the second internal audit position had not been filled, although the assessments obviously had been made and collected. It appears the assessed amount for the cost of the legal services was calculated based on the salary amounts of the two legal counsel positions for October 2012 through June of 2013. However, the monies received from that assessment were used to pay 70% of the early retirement agreement, as well as accumulated annual and sick leave, as we had mentioned before, approximately $90,000. Prior to October of 2012, the salary payments for the former general counsel were from general funds only. Due to the assessed monies being used for the early retirement, it appears the assessed amount for legal services may not be sufficient to cover the costs for the fiscal year 2013 as intended. Our recommendation here was
Senator Hickman.
Mr. Chairman and Gordy, when you talk about this campus assessment, is that something that goes into a fee to the students? Is it just a blank amount per student on each campus? Is it the same amount for each campus? How is it figured?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hickman, I'm not sure how the campuses, the process they used to, you know, to pass that cost on, or if they did. I'm not sure what they, how they used. We didn't trace it back far enough to identify what they used to pay for their portion. Our response there is on the middle of page 14, recommend the university system office make improvements related to the assessment of campuses for paying costs of employees. At a minimum, the system office should obtain proper Board of Higher Education approval prior to assessing the campuses. Ensure assessments are properly budgeted for and accounted for at the system office and the campus level. And ensure monies assessed are used for the purpose for which the assessment was charged. Management's response is they disagree to the extent of the following. For the first part, they recognize the need for good communication with the board and accurate understanding of the board's directives. So steps were taken to communicate with the board regarding the assessment. There is not a board policy requiring approval for assessment, but they do recognize the inconsistency that we noted. They agree with the second part, B, of the of our recommendation, and for C, they want to know.
I have a question.
Sorry, let him finish.
Oh, okay, all right.
The third part, they want to note that the assessed monies have been used to pay for salaries and expenses of the Director of Internal Audit and Risk Assessment, the Chief Compliance Officer, the General Counsel, and the Assistant General Counsel. They do cite that they also used the assessment to cover the salary and benefits included in the former General Counsel's early retirement agreement.
Yeah, Representative Scarpa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gordy, how much total money are we talking about was assessed against the campuses?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I'll have to. How much? $533,000 is what my staff tells me.
And can your staff tell you what the total amount of money that we appropriate to these campuses is on a biennial basis?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure they can't.
Alan, could you give us an approximation, please?
Mr. Chairman, the general fund is about between $600 and $700 million.
Okay, so $533,000 out of say $650 million. So the assessments amount to less than 1/1000th of the money that they receive from the state. Is that correct assessment dollar-wise in my mind?
Mr. Chairman, my a good point is your example would be appropriate if they used general funds to pay for it, but I don't know if they did, so it could be a smaller percentage.
Yeah. My point, Mr. Chairman, is that while it seems like a lot of money, and it is if I got to keep it, in the big scheme of things, it's not a lot of money.
Okay, continue on.
At the bottom of page 14, we talk about improving the internal audit function within the university system. The position is to develop a consistent internal audit methodology and consultative approach, identify potential risk and the corresponding controls throughout the system. We identified some improvements were needed over on page 15. We did identify that, the board in July of 2012 identified a senior level audit position was to be filled for fiscal year 13. As we noted, as of the end of January 13, the position had not been filled. We also identified, when we're talking internal auditors, that as I had mentioned earlier, that there are internal auditors at NDSU and UND that report to their respective presidents. Based on a review of information, it looks like back in March of 12, the board was going to try to move who those internal auditors reported to, but it appears the presidents were able to convince the board that the institutional internal auditors were of greater value reporting within the institutions rather than reporting to the system office. We believe the current reporting structure within the university system for internal auditing is not efficient or effective. As I had mentioned earlier, the Institute of Internal Auditors would support us as far as the independence related to those individuals, and we recommend in the middle of page 15, university system take appropriate action to have internal audit functions within the university system report to the system office personnel rather than to an institution president. The system office agreed and will take appropriate steps to comply with the recommendation. Next, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go over to page 18, if I may. Here we're talking briefly about providing consistent and accurate information. We identified in a particular area that there was a campus that I refer to IPEDS, and that's basically a federal database from the institutions across the country. We identified one institution reported to them that they had 560 degrees were awarded, while a report to the system office indicated that there were 488 degrees awarded. When we talked to system office personnel, they told us they provide oversight in relation to data being completed, but the institutions are responsible for accuracy of the data reported to the IPEDS. They also stated that sometimes institutions use different methodologies when generating data for reporting purposes. The lack of a consistent reporting within the university system is also indicative of another area in which a unified system does not exist. We recommend that the university system take appropriate action to ensure information is provided is consistently and accurately reported. They agreed, and in January of 13, they've established a research and validation work group to ensure data from the campuses and the university office are collected and analyzed and validated appropriately. Mr. Chairman, that would conclude my presentation. We did already, I was going to say, Appendix A is a list of the recommendations. Appendix B.
Gordy, going back to that last response.
Okay.
If they established the research and validation work group back in 2013, why is there still a problem now?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that what we looked at, generally speaking, was through September of 2012. So that work group
I was thinking 2003.
Oh.
I'm thinking, well, I don't expect much, do I?
And Appendix C is just some of the other state's information that we got. And Chapter 3 is just some of the audit and some of the background of what we did. But I'll gladly answer any additional questions.
Mr. Chairman.
That company.
Mr. Chairman, in use 49, I was just looking at like C, and you said that earlier, and I was going to bring that up. You know, we've been using like 39,000. Where's the other 10,000? Is that distant learning, or how are they counting that?
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons we used headcount is because different systems use different methods to come up with what FTE are. I mean, even for us, was it graduate students? Jason, you have to help me here. Undergraduate was 15 credit hours to form one FTE, and graduate was 12. So we thought that student headcount would be a way to kind of equalize that. So that would be the difference between what you've talked about.
Okay. I see you didn't use Wyoming in here. Was there a reason?
I would say we looked at, number one, the organization of the governments. Number two, we did ask the university system for peer institutions. And we did use, I believe, three of the four states that the chancellor used in his comparison for his budget presentation. So we tried to get something that was at least somewhat relevant as far as apples to apples.
Continue.
Mr. Chairman, and University of Alaska and University of South Dakota are probably pretty close, but after that, we're talking three times the population on the next one, and probably five and six times the population of the rest of them. And that's been my problem too on this peer-to-peer business too, has been really questionable. And like you said, just trying to even get an apples-to-apples comparison, that's been for the last 10 years since we've changed that. The higher education system has brought in their peer comparisons and stuff, and that's all. It comes down to figures, and you know how figures work.
Representative Scarpa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gordy, just to go back briefly to the timelines here.
Okay.
You said 2011, 2012, 3 months of 2013. Remind me, if you would, in the committee, when did Chancellor Shirvani begin his tenure?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scarpa, that would have been July 1, I believe, of 2013.
So for the last three...
12, I'm sorry. 2012, yes. So that would have been exactly where you're going, Mr. Chairman, be 3 months of the audit period.
So if you were to give us, or if I were to ask, you know, chapter one where you talk about the lack of a system, can I assume that that would be based on 2011-12 for the most part? And the chapter two where you get into the personnel issues kind of moves into the more... you know, the recent, you know, the 2013 aspect of this?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, when you pick, you know, 24 of the 27 months that we looked at, certainly the majority of those things in Chapter 1 would pertain to the 24-month period.
Any further questions? Do you have any further to add, Gordy? That's it, okay. All right, we'll move on to our next order of business, comments from North Dakota University System regarding the performance audit.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Shivani, North Dakota University System, for the record. Certainly, I would like to thank the State Auditor's Office for their hard work and very comprehensive evaluation. We appreciate their recommendations, and we're certainly going to work on those recommendations to improve the system. A great deal of that, the questions that have been raised, at least the majority of the report, regards to the whole lack of an existing system. And there are a variety of things that are inconsistent and they're not in place, and I suppose that that's why I'm here, and that's why you have so much work to do, and that's why there is such an enormous pushback towards building the system. So a great deal of these issues revolves around consistency of policies, consistency of a structure, from administrative, academic, human resources, capital, and other elements of having a university system. It's not about, I keep saying that it's not about interfering with ongoing management of the individual campuses, but it's about having a clear framework and a structure that is consistent and is comparable. And it's reflected in this audit report. And we have a lot of work to do, and we are going to kind of move in as fast as we can, and we're really grateful to the State Auditor's Office.
Dr. Shivani, do you believe that unification is possible? And in line of Representative Maragos' question, what would your definition of that be?
I would be more than happy, and it's going to be a good two-hour presentation for you, if you would be happy to. But in a nutshell, you know, the unification, let me give you an example to explain. Unification means about certain, having clear, as state auditors articulated here, having a clear set of policies that all campuses follow. And then also making sure, having an oversight that they really do follow. First is designing those policies, and then oversight of that. But those policies are several categories, one administrative, one human resources. Let me, for example, give you an example of that. There is one campus hires a registrar at $80,000, I'm just making this up, but at $80,000, banded. Another campus, that means a state employee, another campus hires the same registrar at $60,000, unbanded. So that's these are the type of inconsistency. One campus, or then regarding financial one, one campus treats student fees as agency funds, the other campus treats it as discretionary funds. One campus, one thing which State Auditor beautifully brought up, I have to admit to you, I'm in quandary, and I still can't get a hold of how the campuses calculate FTE. So when we tell you, well, there are 49,000 headcounts, fine. But how many FTEs are there really? The campuses calculate it in different way. I mean, if you ask me what are the practices, best practices nationally, also there are two different models. Some campuses consider 15 credits of undergraduate per semester. That means 30 credits, a full-time FTE. Some other campuses consider 12 and 12, so 24 credits of undergraduate. And other universities consider 9 credits of graduate as full-time per semester. Some other universities consider 6 of them. But is one or the other? I mean, they're not. But the question is our 11 campuses follow the same format, or one considers 15, one considers 12, one considers something else? And then the question comes up, would they consider online credits into it or not? These are the type of, you know, so there's types of policies, but they're part of, there's certain structures that we have to develop so that we can really be consistently following that, those structures. And it regards, again, administrative, human resources, financial, as well as academic data. This is what we're talking about, the system. And that's how, or capital projects. For example, how do you know, as a legislator, how we can present you with the real facts that what campuses, how much space they need, in what category, and with campus. And these are not something that we can come, I can come up with out of my, head. Even as an architect, we have to have a master plan, a comprehensive master plan that is done, and it scientifically tells us by numbers and by projection that what we need. These are the type of things that we have to do, and we are. And by the way, our policies, as you know, our current policies have been written over years and years and years and have never been really revised. And now that we have a great general counsel, and we are going to, one of the charges is to look at all of our policies and really clean it up, make it up to date, and really elaborate on it on every aspect, so then put it in practice.
Representative Kempinick.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it gets, and I'm going back, I can't really put it, but to get this wheel turned, I mean, and Representative or Senator Lee is correct. I mean, these institutions are operating, they're all unique individuals, and in a certain way, the problem is the system part of this, and the thing is, though, is we got, you know, what was kind of going through this report is that it kind of looks like the chicken or the egg. You know, you got the State Board of Higher Education, you know, there's nothing been really, like, you're, this off, the central office, there isn't, you know, I mean, if there isn't, there isn't some structure around, you know, there's things that happen, but it's more of a reactionary of what goes on than it is of actually directing or steering it. And that's what I'm trying to figure out sitting here. Who's waiting for who? Is the State Board of Higher Education waiting for the legislature to give a hint of, you know, I mean, I hope that this kind of gets something that what we kind of want, because it is the fourth branch of government in this state, and it does get to where, you know, to get something to move that, you know, because we're not big enough to have all these institutions running, you know, I mean, and I'm not saying individually, but we have improved a lot, because at least kids now can transfer from one institution to the other, but like the financial part of it, just kind of what you brought up here, you know, that they, it's something that they can feel comfortable about going forward as far as financing and everything else that goes along with that. So I don't know how you comment on it, but how to get these cogs to mesh is what is frustrating.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kempinen, what you're saying is exactly, you know, I can't talk about what has happened before July 2012, but all I know that the charge is to build the system, and what, let me clarify, so these are all the issues that you're mentioning. We are in the process of doing it and building it. 2 years from now, it would be a completely different. I'm not saying everything would be complete, but it would be a substantial amount of work. But how are we doing it? We're not going to go outside and bring a model and say, okay, now all 11 campuses, you have to adjust into this. In order to build the system, we look at our 11 campuses, and we look at what is going on there, and we try to bring them together, you see what I'm saying, and see what are the areas of best practices within the system, and then we try to create the synergy and build it on it. So it's not going to be completely from outside, but from within, going outside and trying to improve the and bring it to a consistent level. And one thing which you were very interesting, but we do need part of it, as the state auditor beautifully articulated here, that we do need the resources. I mean, somehow these resources have to come that we'll be able to do that. However, you mentioned about the South Dakota. I just wanted to, I would be remiss not to mention, you were talking about South Dakota and Alaska. But South Dakota and Alaska do not have 11 institutions. You see what I'm saying? So the same population, but they have to look at the complexity and size of our institutions. Two research institutions, South Dakota and Alaska, have one research institution, and they don't have that many four-year colleges and two-year colleges. So we have to bear in mind.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Anyone else here to comment on this audit? Okay. Seeing none. Committee, any discussion or directives?
Mr. Chairman, do we need to accept the audit?
Yes, we will. But would you like to make that motion?
Make that motion.
All right. We have a motion from Representative Scarple, seconded from Senator Wanzig. Further discussion? I guess I'll just say I think it achieved its goals. All right. With that, we'll take the roll to accept the audit.
Representatives, Chairman Ruby.
Yes.
Anderson.
Yes.
Bo. Hattelstead.
Yes.
Kempnick.
Yes.
Kreit.
Yes.
Maragos.
No.
Mock.
Yes.
Munson.
Yes.
Pollitt.
Aye.
Scarple.
Yes.
Senators Wanzig.
Yes.
Heckman.
Yes.
Klein.
Aye.
Lee.
Aye.
Motion carries.
All right. Committee, with that, yeah, Representative Mock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Visiting with Senator Heckman, a follow-up is to be conducted, I would assume, looking at previous performance audits. Is that something that's directed by this committee, or is that done automatically by the auditor's office? And if so, when can that be expected to be conducted?
I believe that's through the auditor's office, but Gordy, you could clarify that, please.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Bach, we would do that automatically. We try to schedule that, I'll say, 18 to 24 months after this. We have done some sooner, we have done some later.
Representative Scarpa?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gordy, if it's possible, I think it would be good if you could do it in the 18-month timeframe. And I say that because then it would be available for the next legislative session. I think that would be the most useful to us, rather than have it at the 24 months and have it, you know, after or right during.
Mr. Chairman, that's certainly something we'll consider, yeah.
Well, and thank you for your report, too. All right, committee, anything else? All right, with that, we'll, motion to adjourn? All right, another second? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right, motion carries.